3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Drop your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is the 23rd of July. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Priya. Bang on 7 o'clock. Look at us go.
I know. We are, what can I say? We are nothing if not organized.
Yes.
How are you doing this morning?
Well, yes, I'm good. It is a bit lucky that I'm here. I put my watch on to charge last night to use as an alarm and noticed that instead of going up, the battery was going down. So thankfully, I also put an alarm on my phone, which is good because when I woke up this morning, my watch was dead, which means I probably wouldn't have been here this morning otherwise if I didn't put my phone on. So, phew.
Well, here's the forward planning. I mean, I hope that's not a bad sign for the watch. I really hate planned obsolescence, and I hope that's not what's happening here.
I would really hope so too. I've had it for 3 years. It's seen me through many Ks as a sports watch, as a runner. Yeah, I'm a bit sad about it. But how are you?
I'm doing and I'm going, you know? This is one of the days I've had all week. And that's the truth.
I mean, you do what you can, right?
This is true. And today what we're going to do is bring you some amazing interviews. This is a very exciting lineup of interviewees. And we're starting off with veteran broadcaster and activist Marisa Spasaro, who's the host of 3CR's Do in Time show. And Marisa is going to join us for a conversation about disability support funding for blind and vision impaired people in the context of looming cuts to the NDIS. I'm really excited to be able to have this chat with Marisa. And thank you to Marisa for getting in touch with us after last week's conversation with Oriella Williams from Protect Our NDIS Alliance. Just to add that dimension of what it's like to access specific kinds of funding for disability supports for blind and vision impaired folks and the implications that the proposed cuts will have. And then after that, I'm also very excited to be able to speak with Dr. Sabrina Suluai Mahuka, who is founder of the youth-centered environmental organization Finafinau, who joins us from Pango Pango to discuss recent progress in the United States government's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's moves to advance offshore mineral extraction in the waters off American Samoa. So this is part of a broader conversation about concerns with deep sea mining in the Pacific and the environmental, cultural, and social impacts that this is going to have on Pacific Island nations, and why communities across the Pacific are fighting to resist it.
And finally, well, not finally, next, throughout the week, I was lucky enough to sit down with Isabel Maria Villalon, who is an independent researcher living and studying in Mexico City. She has a master's degree in Latin American studies from the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, is about to enter into a doctorate program, and writes regularly for the North American Congress on Latin America. Now, as the 2026 World Cup wraps up, we'll get to speak with Isabel to unpack the tainted legacy it has left behind throughout Mexico City. She walks us through some inequities in tax contributions paid to Mexico, Canada, and the US by participating corporations, and the rejection of the tournament by a broad assembly of social movements that led to street protests. That will be a two-part conversation that we will listen to. And then finally, we will listen to a podcast produced with all the best radio international audio producer Craig Garrett and our Thursday breakfast host, awkward, myself, about the growing push for reproductive healthcare leave across Australia. The podcast features Emma Hardy, a writer with lived experience of managing PMDD in the workplace, Carolyn Dunbar, the women's team leader at the Victorian Trades Hall Council and advocate for the union's campaign It's for Everybody, and Tom Havala, a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne, who adopts a feminist approach to push for greater legal protections within the workplace.
Amazing. I am very much looking forward to today's show. And please remember, we are with you all the way through until 8:30 a.m. when you will be joined by the Lost in Science crew. So stay tuned. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 a.m. And we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favorite radio program is produced? On Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2026. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July. See you then.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 23rd of July. The Israeli embassy has made an extraordinary intervention in Australian government domestic politics by publicly criticizing the draft Labour Party program on what Labour refers to as the Israel-Gaza conflict being raised at Labour's national conference, which starts today in Adelaide. Critics say Israel's public intervention goes well beyond normal diplomatic engagement and that attempts to influence the internal policy deliberations of a political party crosses a line and raises serious concerns about foreign interference in the Australian government's democratic processes.
Also in headlines, earlier this week, hundreds of anti-war and land rights activists rallied outside the Pine Gap military base near Empantwe Alice Springs, calling for the secretive Australian United States government facility to be closed and the land to be returned to Arrente traditional owners. The rally presented the largest protest at the site since 1987, with advocates travelling from across countries to join long-standing efforts. Arrente elders delivered a letter to the base demanding the return of Kuyumba, compensation for the occupation of the land and access to sacred sites. Protesters also called out Pine Gap's intelligence sharing role in Israel's genocide in Gaza. Organisers said they will continue campaigning against Pine Gap and the Australian government's military ties with the United States, including in protests against AUKUS later this year.
In other news, the Northern Territory government's proposed changes to child protection laws continue to be sharply condemned. Experts say the proposed laws would weaken protections designed to keep First Nations children connected to families and communities, and ministers from every state and territory except Queensland and the Northern Territory have called on the federal government to intervene to stop the legislation passing. The Northern Territory already has the country's lowest rates of kinship placements for First Nations children in out-of-home care, and experts argue the proposed changes ignore evidence that children placed with kin experience lower rates of harm.
In other news, new research based on people transferred by the federal government to Nauru found 99% could not afford enough food, with many reporting skipped meals, weight loss and worsening mental health. The Asylum Seeker Resource Centre produced the report and is calling on the federal government to end its offshore detention, which cost almost $1 billion in the past year, arguing that people seeking asylum are being denied basic necessities and that the Australian government is failing in its duty of care.
And finally, in headlines, Victorian public school teachers are planning to strike today after members of the Australian Education Union's Victorian branch rejected the state government's latest offer. Union representatives say the offer is not much different from the previously rejected offer and failed to adequately address issues raised, including reducing class sizes and meeting pay rise demands for all sections of the workforce. In the face of bad faith behaviour from the Department of Education, including a short turnaround time for response from union members, teachers and supporters continue to rally. Union members will march from Bourke Street to Parliament House today as part of the 24-hour industrial action. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 23rd of July, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from So Called Australia and beyond. ultimately we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2026. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July. See you then.
You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are joined by our first guest for today, veteran broadcaster and activist Marisa Spassaro, host of 3CR's Doin' Time show, for a conversation about disability support funding for blind and vision impaired folks in the context of looming cuts to the NDIS. In this conversation, we cover how different kinds of funding funding allocations facilitate inclusion for blind and vision impaired people under the NDIS, the implications of losing access, and more broadly, the way that conversations about legitimate support and functionality assessments occur within a society that holds very narrowed views about the kinds of lives that people with disabilities should live. And remember, you can catch the Doing Time show from 4 to 5 p.m. on Mondays on 3CR. Good morning, Marisa. How's it going?
Good morning. You have certainly revved me up.
Well, I mean, honestly, it is, it's an honour to be interviewing somebody who has a much more storied career on 3CR than myself. And so I was absolutely delighted to get your email the other day, you know, reflecting on what Auriella had shared from the Protect Our NDIS Alliance and, you know, offering to provide some further analysis from the perspective of, you know, being somebody who navigates the NDIS from a different sort of set of funding allocations. So I wanted to begin by asking why you think blind and vision impaired people have tended to be overlooked in conversations about planned cuts to the NDIS.
Blindness and vision impairment are overlooked because the NDIS considers them to be low incidence. So it's about low incidence disability. Hence, there are a very limited number of services which have specialist knowledge pertaining to them. So, as you know, Priya, the NDIS amendment securing the NDIS Future Generations Bill 2026 is happening. It's been introduced to Parliament, and I believe Auriella would have talked about that during her very amazing interview a couple of weeks ago. But reform must not come at the cost of people losing the supports they rely on to live independently, work and participate in the community. So for people who are blind and vision impaired, supports like assistive technology, orientation and mobility training and community access are simply not optional. They are essential for safety and participation. And often what tends to happen is that this conversation is overlooked because blindness and vision impairment are simply not considered high priority for the government. And it is severely misunderstood. Mm. And as a person with lived experience, whenever I'm out in the community, I'm often approached by people, well, how will you do this? How do you do that? How do you get on the train? How do you shower? 3CR is one of the very few places where I feel safe, and also activist circles. And by the way, I don't broadcast on disability. It is actually a decision that I have made. I broadcast on the passions that I have because it's really important that because I am a blind person, that doesn't mean that I need to do disability broadcasting. And that's just a decision that I've made. And 3CR doesn't pressure me to do that. Mm. But in answer to your question, Priya, I think it's overlooked simply because there is a severe lack of understanding, and also there's ableism about this.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, we'll come back to that point that you made about, you know, being able to broadcast on something that you're interested in rather than thinking about, you know, a feature of your life defining how you should approach the world, because I really would like to unpack that with you a bit more about societal expectations. But coming back to, you know, the concerns and, you know, daily needs of the lives of blind and vision impaired people being overlooked in these conversations, I wanted to ask you a bit about how the system kind of works. So an explanation about NDIS funding and the differences between what are called core, capital, and capability supports when it comes to the requirements of blind and vision impaired people.
Absolutely. So I'll start off by looking at, this is kind of a little bit new to me as well, so excuse me here. So I'll give you an explanation about the differences between core, capital, and capacity supports when it comes to the requirements of blind and vision impaired people. And I think Ariella did speak a little bit about this, not in regards to vision impairment, but in regards to her disability. So, for example, assistance with daily life. Those are the supports that assist or supervise you with your personal tasks during day-to-day life that enable you to live as independently as possible. And these supports can be provided individually in a range of environments, including your own home and support to maintain the home to a good standard. So looking at domestic help, house cleaning and other household activities. And then you've got your assistance with social, economic and community participation. And those are supports that assist or, you know, engaging in the community, social, recreational or economic activities. And these supports are provided in environments such as in the community or a centre. And what was that? Were you talking about capital then?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the capital's important. So the capital supports would include high-cost assistance technology. And for a blind person, that would be like equipment. So, for example, the JAWS screen reader software that helps the blind and vision impaired person to navigate documents and internet access and read books and for work commitments. And also, so the capital, you know, you'd get equipment modifications, repairs, things like that. I mean, we're coming into a digital age, so blind and vision impaired people would need more help to buy that equipment. And it's thousands of dollars. I mean, it'd be about $8,000 to $10,000, sometimes up to $20,000 that people would be doing that, I mean, buying equipment. And then going back to the other support, which is to do with the social stuff and the domestic cleaning, often what tends to happen is that you know, there are difficulties with performing certain tasks. For example, vacuuming would be difficult. Also, going to unfamiliar places. So you would be having support workers to take blind and vision impaired people, you know, where they need to go. But of course, not everybody needs a support worker. Like, a lot of the time, you're having your orientation and mobility to help you to navigate from Guide Dogs Victoria, for example.
Yeah.
Does that give you a bit of a
idea? That is very helpful. And you know, I take your point about not everybody needing to have a support worker or desiring to have a support worker around, but more having the opportunity to have a run through an orientation to be able to then navigate things independently. And I did want to build on that to talk about the interactions between these different types of funding, because, you know, we've talked about the fact that losing capacity building or capability funding will have implications for your ability then to use things that are funded under capital supports. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Sorry, can you rephrase that?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, I remember us having a conversation about, you know, what it means to lose access in one category of funding for your ability to, you know, make the most of things that are funded under another. So say you're using this kind of JAWS software, but you do also need training to be able to use the software and that kind of thing.
Okay, so that goes under capacity building.
Mm-mm.
So basically you can use the funding in the same category.
Okay.
So for example, you can, in the capacity building category, you can pay for a support like training. And so you can be trained to actually use JAWS, for example, or use a Braille display, which you attach to the computer. It's quite complex. There needs to be a Braille computer all in one. But you know how many devices I've got here? I've got about 8 or 9.
Wow.
And I've bought most of them out of my own money.
Mm.
So, but what's important to note here is that functional assessments are always very, very difficult for blind and vision impaired people. And with these changes, it may be that those functional assessments will become a lot more stringent, and not everybody gets the equipment that they need or the training they need.
Mm. And that training piece, I think, is quite an important one, right? Because, like, you can access the equipment, or you may be able to access the equipment, but actually being able to use it in a competent way to understand the full functionality of what you're accessing is what allows it to enhance your life.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, and I can only speak from my own lived experience, groundbreaking work has happened with radio broadcasting for me, because I'm actually now learning editing, and through the JAWS software and doing training around that. But of course, I'd be needing specialist trainers who also have a vision impairment to assist me with that. And I actually didn't ever think that I would get a trainer with a vision impairment, because of the fact that a lot of people in the blind community find me very intimidating, because of the fact that I do hold views that are somewhat radical in terms of the blind community. A lot of them are very right-wing. And I'm not necessarily speaking about individuals here, but I'm speaking about the fact that the blind community really does not have access to a lot of education in terms of, for example, freeing Palestine or what's happening at Pine Gap.
Mm.
Because I don't think that Braille libraries would source that type of information, unless you want, you know, they wouldn't cover anarchist literature. So I suppose what I'm saying here is that in terms of that capacity building category, that I consider it very important that blind and vision impaired people with small businesses are incorporated. And so I make it a policy that I do not, it's my own personal policy, that I do not work with major organisations for computer training.
Mm.
I make sure that, and I have a very modest plan because I don't want or need a lot of money in my NDIS plan, and I plan to get off it as soon as possible, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, that training is very, very important for blind people to work in that area to help me instead of the major organisation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, you've definitely touched on something there that you mentioned at the start, which is, you know, about the sort of broader social environment that blind and vision impaired people, you know, access information in and participate in society in. And I think that that point about a lack of access to, you know, political education materials that are made accessible is a vital one. And I did want to ask you about how various sort of support funding demands that people with disability adhere to cultural and social norms when accessing supports, and the implications that this has for radical folks with disability like yourself, who, you know, are going to be, you know, pushing against the norms of what people feel should fall within the bounds of a disabled life.
Well, that would take a whole show, really. But
well, we'll have to have you back.
I wouldn't even know where to start. But I think one of the things is that you've got, you know, the fact that, you know, disability, the cost of disability is very high, okay? So in terms of looking at that cultural norm, like, for example, there's no way that I would get self-defence paid for with an NDIS support. And I think it's extremely important for everybody to have self-defence, to, you know, to do a self-defence course.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that would happen, but that would be very important for blind and vision impaired people to have safety. And I know for myself, when I'm actually at a protest, you know, I'm out at my business to do non-violence training, for example.
Mm.
But, you know, these days, you need to be able to have self-defence. And self-defence doesn't necessarily just mean defending yourself physically. It's really important to be able to set boundaries and to be able to learn self-defence. And that definitely wouldn't be paid for.
Mm. Yeah. And, I mean, you know, just thinking about all of the activism that you've been involved in throughout your life, like, I can imagine that if it's if the discussion about funding comes up in terms of the things that support you to live a meaningful life, you know, various conservative cuts to the NDIS folks might have a bit to say about what is and isn't appropriate, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've got economic vulnerability here for blind folks. And NDIS is not always supportive when it comes to that. And intersecting people with disability also with structural oppressions such as racism and sexism and harmful impacts of poverty, pollution, and other oppressions.
Mm-mm-mm. And I think the way that the economic structure of funding almost puts people in a position where you don't want to put access to the world and your ability to live a dignified life at risk, you know, by doing something that, you know, could put your funding at jeopardy. Feels like a really difficult bind.
Oh, I see what you mean. You know, you can't, I mean, basically, you can't talk about that stuff during an assessment.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine? I want to go on a forest blockade and I hitchhiked from Orbost down to the blockade and I need funding for mobility to get there.
not a chance. Oh, but I mean, it is, you know, I think it is a really important conversation when it comes to thinking about not just social participation, but like robust political participation, right?
Indeed, and I think that's seriously lacking. Let's face it. Look, the NDIS is a reflection of the sick society that we live in. I mean, and it sounds really negative. I'm a bit of a realist. And, you know, when you're interviewing Aboriginal elders and you're interviewing, you know, you're working with genocidal content, you know yourself, week after week, you tend to kind of think, well, what's happening?
Yeah, and I mean, it is a it's a bit of a sobering note to leave us on. But I do think, you know, keeping in mind that these systems that are in place, you know, as important as it is to defend access to that funding, also have to be responsive to people pushing for a different kind of society, you know, trying to actually fight for liberation for all people in a meaningful way that, you know, really integrates disability justice within that fight. And so, yeah, I honestly, Marissa, I'd love to have you back on again. We do have to wrap up right now, but is there anything?
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
Just one last thing.
Go ahead.
Very quickly. I just wanted to also say as well that the changes, the NDIS changes are actually going to be, could be quite detrimental because they want to take away the social supports for people. And, you know, so if people are going to be losing that, there's going to be a lot of isolation and losing capital supports, people won't be able to buy the high cost technology. So it's really important that, you know, blind and vision impaired people need to build their skills and increase independence through orientation and mobility, through the other capacity building supports. And how are they going to do that if that's taken away?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a very important important reminder for people listening. And, yeah, really appreciate you making the time, Marissa.
Thank you so much. Look, this is not my strong point. I mean, I can only speak from my lived experience, but I felt like it was important to really expand on what Ariella was saying. I'm best at doing time, I think, and other topics.
No, but I think like sometimes being able to bring the really incisive political analysis that you share at Do and Time to these issues of lived experience is just a vital way for people to get a better understanding of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
See you in the street sometime.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
And that was Marissa Sposaro, the host of 3CR's Do and Time show, who joined us for a conversation about disability support funding for blind and vision impaired people in the context of looming cuts to the NDIS. And remember, you can catch Do and Time from 4 to 5pm on Mondays on 3CR 855am.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR, 855 on the AM dial, podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR Digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:35 in the morning, and we are now joined by Dr. Sabrina Suluai Mahuka, who is founder of youth-centered environmental organization Finafinau. And Sabrina joins us from Pangopango to discuss recent progress in the United States government's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's moves to advance offshore mineral extraction in the waters off American Samoa. Now, on the 16th of July, in the face of significant resistance in American Samoa and across the Pacific region, the BOEM agency issued a proposed leasing notice for the American Samoa Outer Continental Shelf Pacific Mineral Lease Sale 1. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's another step in the direction of a potential lease sale this November. And so Sabrina is going to speak with us about the cultural and environmental impacts that deep sea mining for critical minerals will cause and the ongoing fight to prevent this from happening in the waters off the islands of American Samoa. Now, Dr. Sabrina Suluai Mahuka is a Samoan-Filipina educator, youth leadership mentor, and environmental justice advocate who works at the intersection of Indigenous knowledge, community organizing, and ocean conservation to amplify Pacific voices in local and global decision-making. Hi, Sabrina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Hello?
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I think our line is a bit quiet, but let me just hold on a sec and let me see if I can reconnect you through a different option. Give me a moment. Okay. Listeners, bear with me for a sec. Now, Sabrina, so to ground our conversation, I want to remind listeners that Finafinau is based in Pangopango on the island of Tutuila. So tell me about this place, the waters around the islands of American Samoa, their cultural value, and your relationship to them.
Absolutely. In American Samoa, the ocean is not scenery, and I think that resonates with many other Pacific islands. We're not an empty blue space surrounding our islands, and it is certainly not a warehouse of minerals waiting to be opened. Our moana, our ocean, is our highway, our pantry, our classroom, our church, our genealogy, and in the end, it's our inheritance. And so many of our family stories are tied to this water. And an example of that, I am descended from a canoe maker from Olosenga in Manua. And many of our family members on this island have worked in the tuna industry. We've taught about protecting our waters. We've taught our children. We've been taught by our parents to be people of the ocean. And so when we're talking about the ocean, we're not talking about something that's abstract. We're speaking about a system that has fed our families, carried our ancestors, and shaped our culture, and of course, made life on these islands possible. I've also had the privilege of visiting Rose Atoll or Muliaba, and it is also one of the most pristine places I have ever witnessed in my lifetime. And being there really changed how I understand our responsibility to uphold the Fa Samoa, the Samoan values. And very few people will really understand what it means to be there in person, but that doesn't make protecting it less valuable. It means it's our duty to protect it even more. And so our relationship with the ocean is reciprocal. I don't see the ocean separate from our islands. The ocean is American Samoa.
Yeah, that is such a beautiful way to put it. And look, Sabrina, I wanted to turn to this question of deep sea mining, which has received a lot of critical attention in recent years. And it's been the subject of cultural and environmental justice campaigns, including in the Pacific region as well as elsewhere. And in the case of American Samoa, can you briefly take us through a timeline of key events in the Trump administration's plan to fast-track offshore mining, culminating in the July 16th announcement by the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management about this availability of a proposed leasing plan?
Yes, it's important to understand how quickly this process has moved. In April of 2025, there's an executive order that came out from President Trump to direct the federal government to accelerate seabed mineral exploration, leasing, and permitting. And then less than a month later, in May, the Department of Interior announced that it was evaluating a request for potential mineral lease sale offshore our waters near American Samoa. And they formally announced that in June of 2025. And initially, it was about for 18 million acres of the outer continental shelf northeast of Manu'a Island and Rose Atoll. The original public comment period was only 30 days, but after a request from our government, it was extended until up to 60 days. And so during that period, people in American Samoa, members of the diaspora, scientists and organizations and global allies actually submitted over 76,000 comments to the official BOEM site. A majority of them were in opposition. However, despite all of that opposition, in November of 2025, BOEM moved forward and completed what was called the area of identification. And it went from 18 million acres to about 33 million acres. So they almost doubled the area ID despite all the opposition. And they were doing community consultations, and I say that very lightly because the community that they've only met with is government agencies or government entities here in American Samoa, not the actual community. And now that has moved forward. They did their supposed NEPA review. NEPA is their environmental review that they did. And in particular, they only did an environmental assessment, which is a desk study, because they're saying this is only for preliminary activities for exploration. However, if a lease is given, it would be for a minimum of 20 years. And on July 16th, which was ironic because it was Manu'a Flag Day, which should be celebrating Manu'a's relationship with the U.S., BOEM decided to move forward and put out the proposed leasing notice, which basically is a bid for a home. Yes, that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, I mean, it just the lack of regard for concerns that have been raised by the people, again, as you said, who were not directly consulted with or, you know, listened to in any meaningful way, despite putting in so many submissions, is very concerning. And I think, you know, to contextualize these concerns, I want to talk about what deep sea mining is. So it involves the extraction of critical minerals through the collection of seafloor polymetallic nodules, which includes metals such as cobalt, nickel, and manganese, which are very important in the tech industry. Now, what impacts could deep sea mining have on the ocean environment, both locally around American Samoa and further afield? And how might this impact things like American Samoa's local economy, especially in tuna fishing, which you mentioned that your family has been involved in as well?
Yes, the first thing I would say about deep sea mining is that we have to be honest about the science. There are no commercial scale deep sea mining efforts taking place anywhere in the world for these nodules. And so anything that would occur, American Samoa would basically be the testing site because there is not a mature industry with decades of evidence showing that it can be done safely. Some of the industry players, like Impossible Metals, was one of the loudest folks to say that they want to mine safely in our waters, or they propose technology that's AI generated. But their startup is less than 10 years, and folks here have clothes that are older than their startup. So that doesn't make any sense on our end, right? And these mining nodules would involve industrial machines moving across the seabed, removing nodules that took millions of years to form. And so we wouldn't even see that, be replaced within our lifetimes. And that would be disturbing the sediment, destroying habitat, because there is life on these nodules itself. That would be a lot of generating noise and light pollution that normally doesn't see that amount of movement or sound in the first place. And of course, that would be sending mined material through the water column to the surface levels. And that's probably where that a lot of the concern comes from, too, is that sediment disturbance or the sediment plumes could travel for miles and smother our coral reefs, which we absolutely depend on to make sure that our ocean is healthy for us to sustain our livelihoods of fishing and feeding our families. And we see scientists around the world showing that This is definitely a possible effect of deep sea mining, and they're calling for a pause, a precautionary pause, because once removed for these nodules, right, they don't grow back within a human time scale. There's no restoration that would come from it. There are case studies, I think, off the coast of North Carolina that they did in a lake that they still haven't recovered for decades after experimenting there. With Papua New Guinea, with the Solera project, we show that this is not financially a good decision. They were left with over $100 million worth of debt. And so this is, you know, it raises the question, if we're still mapping the waters and documenting what lives there, how can we really say that we're prepared to lease? How can we say that American Samoa is ready to bear all the risk from a decision that's made at a desk?
Yeah, and when you talk about bearing all the risk, again, I want to emphasize it's bearing all the risk of things that are still, you know, unknown in terms of the scale of impacts that they can cause, but all indications suggest that they will be severe and widespread. And we don't even know what remediation could look like afterwards. So to sort of put the cart before the horse, so to speak, and begin by expanding the possibilities of extraction and exploration without waiting for confirmations about the scale of the impact that this could have is really, really concerning. And I did want to ask about how this fits into the broader governance concerns that are at play here, because American Samoa is an unincorporated U.S. territory, where, as far as I understand, the U.S. has authority over the territory, but American Samoans don't have access to the same kinds of constitutional rights as people in the continental United States. So I wanted to ask if you could unpack some of the implications that this governance arrangement has for resisting deep sea mining in American Samoa's waters. And, you know, how much power does the governor of American Samoa have in this matter?
Yes, it's an interesting place where we sit as a territory for the U.S. We are technically labeled as unincorporated and an unorganized U.S. territory. So not every constitutional provision applies here the same way it does to a state. And so people here in American Samoa are usually U.S. nationals rather than citizens by birth. And so we technically can't vote for the president, even though we live here in a U.S. territory. And that also applies for those folks like myself who are U.S. citizens. Because we have chosen to live here in American Samoa, we voided our right to vote in the U.S. elections. In addition, for our congressional delegates, they can introduce legislation and vote in committees, but they can't actually vote in the final passage of legislation on the House floor. We also don't have a senator. And so there is definitely a profound democratic imbalance there. And I think that's prominent for most folks here saying, if it's in federal waters, you know, what control do we have? But it's with the understanding that our deeds of cession were this treaty that we made with the U.S. as our sovereign nation, it was built on mutual respect and mutual benefits. And deep sea mining, it's not an environmental issue itself. It's a territorial democracy and environmental justice issue. But our governor does have a very important role to play. Right now, within this 60-day period, he can demand a full environmental impact statement instead of that environmental assessment. He can also ask for a government administrative office review to say, can we look into this BOEM process and, you know, are they doing shortcuts that are not meaningful community engagement, or are they expediting it where our consent is not given, right? And so they can definitely submit formal objections and even here introduce, like following Guam's example of introducing a bill to ban or fine any deep sea mining vessels that come to our ports. You know, at least that's within our jurisdiction to say, sure, if you're going to mind this, we're going to make it extremely expensive for you. We're going to make this hard. You can't use our ports unless you want to pay this outrageous fine. And so there's so many things that we can do. It's just a matter of taking those actions. And then one thing, you know, just to make clear is we understand that the United States is our sovereign nation, but the U.S. should not use the limits of our political status as an advantage to accessing our natural resources or eliminating, you know, our livelihoods and our identity that's tied to these waters. We're governed by decisions that we can't fully vote on with our status as U.S. nationals or living here as U.S. citizens. But that's, you know, that we do contribute to the United States. Our children can join the military and give their lives to the United States. So we should be able to vote for things that matter for our children.
Yeah, that is such a profound way to put it. And I think very important to understand the governance arrangements, but also the fact that, you know, there are many ways for people in American Samoa to push back and continue to resist. And so just in view of wrapping up, I did want to ask Sabrina, how is the American Samoan community continuing to push back against deep sea mining, and what's next? And also, how can our listeners here in so-called Australia support your efforts?
That's a great question. And so I think our community has been absolutely amazing in our resistance. It is rooted in education. It's rooted in culture, faith. It's rooted in community, and especially rooted in alofa, love for our home. And that really starts with trying to become experts overnight, right? To say what information is based on facts, based on citations. And so we've been working on getting the community access to public resources, fact sheets, putting up billboards so folks can have access to it, and also just understand that, you know, there are so many communities that are not online. And so going out to the community and hosting forums and opportunities for residents to ask questions directly. They've submitted public comments, written to territorial and federal leaders. Just last, on July 16th, ironically, we had already planned a united gathering for a Stand with the Moana. And one thing to note is Samoan people usually don't protest because, you know, it can be seen as disrespectful. But we did have this demonstration of community members where we prayed. We thought about the ocean and reflection. We brought flowers as tribute, and we stood publicly for our waters and our home. And while the action was peaceful, it was not passive, because we want it to be visible to our local decision makers, but also national, and of course our allies in the region and with our Pacific brothers and sisters, that our opposition is not limited to one day. It's not limited to one organization or political party or one moment. We have to continue to oppose and be as loud as we can in our opposition, respectfully, but still very loud, to say we are participating in every stage of this process, and it's going to still be a no. And so we don't need everyone to be an expert. We just need everyone to not be idle. Everyone around the world can stand with us, and we super appreciate that. And I think that individually we can create this ripple, but we really need to become stronger to become an unstoppable tidal wave. And so we might be the first on a federal map, but we will not be the first to become the sacrificial site. And so our allies from anywhere in the world, they can write and connect and meet with their elected officials. If that's within the U.S., their senators, their House of Representatives, get them on board to support a national moratorium. Our regional partners, how can we push for a moratorium worldwide, globally, right? We really need as much help as possible. And we can leverage social media to say that we're not going down without a fight. Mm. And if that's creating media on their own end to show why this is such a horrible idea, that would be great. If that's amplifying the voices that's already here, that would be great as well. So,
yeah.
Yes, we would appreciate anything we can get.
Of course, and we will share information about how to find out more about the work of Finifanau and all of the incredible organizing that you're doing in our show notes. But for now, Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for meeting with us and sharing our stories.
Thank you. And you are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. That was Dr. Sabrina Suluai Mahuka, founder of youth-centered environmental organization Finafinau, who joined us from Pangopango to discuss recent progress in the United States government's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's moves to advance offshore mineral extraction in the waters off American Samoa and the ongoing fight back. Now, we might go straight to our next segment for today, and this is a very exciting one and an important one, I think, as people reflect on the World Cup that was. Kate?
Yes, so I was lucky enough to sit down with Isabel Maria Villalon, who is an independent researcher living and studying in Mexico City. She has a master's degree in Latin American studies from the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, is about to enter into a doctorate program, and writes regularly for the North American Congress on Latin America. Now, as Priya just stated, as the 2026 World Cup wraps up, we were fortunate to speak with Isabel to unpack the tainted legacy it has left behind throughout Mexico City. She walks us through inequities in tax contributions paid to Mexico, Canada, and the US by participating corporations, and the rejection of the tournament by a broad assembly of social movements that led to street protests. Throughout the conversation, Isabel sheds light on structural economic inequalities present across both legislation governing the World Cup within Mexico and negotiations for the United States-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement that occurred alongside the tournament. So, without further ado. Thank you so much, Isabel, for speaking with me. I'm very excited to chat with you about... I know that you are an independent researcher and you're studying your master's in Latin American studies, and you've recently looked into dynamics that are happening in the lead up to and throughout the World Cup or the Mundial. And so I thought maybe we could get started with looking into, I mean, the World Cup has just wrapped up for 2026. And I was just wondering what has been the general response to the hosting of the event throughout Mexico City, and were people supportive of it?
Yeah, I think with regards to the general response to the games, I think it was, on one hand, there was, I think, a just generalized excitement. Mexico has, there's a very, you know, like a lot of like, national pride around Mexico, and also a lot of that is tied to, you know, Mexico's relationship with the United States. Mexico was the only country that was co-hosting the World Cup this year that is, well, it's like a previously colonized country. Canada and the United States are both settler colonies and has a historic relationship of subordination and just general bullying by the United States. So there was, on one hand, something really kind of beautiful that arose from that, with the solidarity that the Mexican people had with, like, Iran, for example, and also just, like, I mean, with different, with all the different peoples that were coming through Mexico, that I think was very particular to Mexico's hosting of the games and was a source of a lot of pride and solidarity, which was really beautiful. On the other hand, there was, from before the games even started, a massive rejection and indignation about what the games represented because of that, the same reason, right? That Mexico has historically been subordinated in not only in the situation, not only in the dynamics regarding the World Cup, but economically to the United States, to the rest of North America. And there was just a general question of who is this game for, right? I mean, because Mexican people were systematically excluded. Not only, I mean, just starting with the ticket prices, the ticket prices were around, it was like five times Mexican minimum wage. There was a huge security perimeter around the stadium here in Mexico City. So you couldn't come in, you couldn't enter. It was heavily militarized. And then there was a lot of public investment in different infrastructure and touristification projects, which I think on one hand, I mean, the government defended by saying, well, you know, once the World Cup ends, the infrastructure projects will stay. But a lot of them were just beautification projects that had no actual material benefit for the Mexican people, right? But public funds were being channeled towards these projects. I mean, there was one, for example, that was heavily criticized. There's a metro station here in Mexico City that that they beautified with like some chandeliers, and it was this like whole extravagant thing. And there was a lot of frustration because, you know, there's a big population of people here living in Mexico City that are their wages don't extend to just for their basic social reproduction, for them to be able to buy what it is that they need to do. There's huge problems that have arisen the last couple years around displacement, around gentrification. And so there was this question about, like, is this where public funds should be channeled towards, right? Mm. So since the games were announced and Mexico was announced as hosting the games, there was massive mobilizations and a lot of like intersectoral and intermovement organizing to reject this general sentiment of like, you know, this multi-billion-dollar corporation coming into Mexico and reproducing these historic dynamics of exploitation that exclude the Mexican people and only benefit the ultra wealthy of the world.
Mm. It's like a mix of excitement, but also like who gets to be excited and who gets to benefit from everything that's happening. And you spoke a little bit about, I guess, public investment that went into hosting the games, and there has been significant public investment from the Mexican government into the hosting of the World Cup. Now, aside from profits perhaps made by tourism and entertainment industries throughout the World Cup, there's also taxes paid to host governments by participating corporations such as FIFA, Coca-Cola, Adidas. However, you've been looking into some inequities in windfall profits from these taxes across the United States, Canada, and Mexico. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what you found.
Yeah, so the hosting of the games was actually negotiated in 2016. It was negotiated during Trump's first term with Enrique Peña Nieto, who's he was like a far-right neoliberal president that was in power before Morena got into power, and then Justin Trudeau. So during that time, it was during that time that the Ley de Ingresos was negotiated, and it was negotiated under Peña Nieto. So that's important to point out because Morena has been insisting on it. Right now, there's a very progressive government in power in Mexico. That it was something that was inherited, like they really didn't have a whole lot of choice around it. Mm. But essentially what the Ley de Ingresos does is it provides complete tax exemptions, not only to FIFA as an organization, because FIFA as an organization is actually tax exempt in the United States. It's considered a nonprofit, ridiculously, but it is. And so they're tax exempt in the United States as well. But the difference is that in Mexico, it's not only FIFA as an organization, it's the teams, it's the broadcasters, it's all of the subsidiaries and all of the corporate partnerships, like you said, like Visa, Coca-Cola, Adidas. So it's this entire economic ecosystem surrounding all of the games that was tax exempt. Meanwhile, FIFA made around $1.8 to $2.8 billion for hosting the games just in Mexico. Which just brings us back to this question of who is this for? Who is this benefiting, right? And at what costs?
Mm-hmm. And what about like the United States and Canada? How did the tax system differentiate between the tax system that was set up within Mexico?
Yeah, so in the United States, they're exempt from paying federal and state taxes. But the web of like sponsors, contractors, companies that are working to put on the tournament, they're all paying taxes. Mm-hmm. The same is true for in Canada, and also those two nations had the ability of being able to they raise taxes. So people's consumption taxes were raised to compensate for the loss in taxes from hosting the games and FIFA not paying its part, right? The difference is that Mexico, and I think that it's also important to point out that this dynamic it's not something that happened in a vacuum, and it's not something that's only specific to FIFA, but it has everything to do with like the global organization of power and capital and Mexico's position within that. And Mexico is consistently put in a place of it does not hold the same bargaining power in these negotiations as the United States and Canada, because it doesn't have the same infrastructure to be able to host these games, because it has been subjected to a history of, you know, colonial coercion that has forced it to consistently have, you know, be producing, you know, like lower wage and lower income products, like, you know, avocados and agricultural products. Meanwhile, they're importing industrial products from the United States, which creates an inequality in the value flows between the two countries. And so for Mexico to be able to, like, have the competitive edge, for them to be able to participate in the games and be able to generate the income, even though there was a huge loss in taxes, like you said, there was a lot of income that was also generated surrounding just, like, consumption and tourism. For them to be able to do that, they have to give up the bigger concessions than the United States and Canada. And this is something that's structural and has everything to do with history and the organization of our, you know, our social relations globally.
Yeah, a really big systemic bind that's probably very hard to, I imagine, get out of.
Yes, exactly.
And there were major protests held in the lead up to and throughout the World Cup across Mexico by a coalition of social movements. Now, in an anti-World Cup Instagram page that you shared with me called Antifa Anti-FIFA, one post says, "Ninguna copa vale más que nuestras vidas," which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this translates to no cup is worth more than our lives. I was wondering if you could explain some of the main issues and actors that were driving protests against the World Cup.
Yeah, so there was a diverse coalition of protesters, or like of movements. I think the post that you refer to there, what I imagine it has to do with is the question of forced disappearances in Mexico. That was one of the central demands. There was a lot of movements that were demanding that Mexico, instead of channeling these funds towards these touristification projects and, you know, these beautification projects I just described, that instead they channel those funds towards searching for the disappeared in Mexico. There's currently, if I'm not mistaken, about 133,000 people that have been disappeared in Mexico. And there's different movements that really, really strong social movements. There's one particularly that's called the Madres Buscadoras. Mm-hmm. And they're mothers that are organized that have disappeared children. And they were one of the main social forces behind the protests. There was also families from the 43 disappeared students from Ayotzinapa. And then beyond that, there was a lot of union demands. There were transportation workers that were demanding more security on highways. There were farmers that were demanding, you know, more fair prices for the price of basic grains like corn and beans, which also, once again, has everything to do with, you know, with unequal exchange and economic subordination of Mexico. And yeah, so I think on one hand, all of these movements, and then also there was a bunch of the anti-gentrification movement has been getting stronger and stronger in Mexico City. They had an important presence, and just different movements that were fighting against displacement. There was a slogan surrounding the World Cup that said "El Mundial de Despojo." And if you actually walk around Mexico City, you can see everywhere graffiti painted that says "No al Mundial de Despojo," no, which is just like a demand that makes reference to the inequality that it represents and how the hosting of the games was increasingly making the poor poorer and the rich richer through systems of displacement. So I think on one hand, all of these movements, like I said, Mexico, the Mexican people are highly organized, and there's a lot of really important historic social movements in the country. And so I think that a lot of those movements and unions used the World Cup as a stage where they could, you know, like shed light on their demands and also, you know, use leverage against the government, because it was a very, you know, important moment for the government and not the moment that you wanted protest to take over the street, but that's exactly what happened, right? So they saw a strategic point and leverage that they could make to make their demands, leverage they could have to make their demands. But then at the same time, I think there was a generalized sentiment, and there was also a lot of intermovement coordination and different marches that expressed this other idea, which is like central. And I think really in a lot of ways, the root issue behind all of the specific movement demands, which is once again, coming back to this question of what, like of an economic system that is constantly keeping the poor, the poor countries poor, in favor of the ultra wealthy and in favor of systems that are constantly, channeling the value and the labor, or sorry, the value that Mexican labor creates towards other parts of the world, you know? So I think a lot of the demands, they were around the generalized inequality that the games represented.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
And you speak about this dynamic throughout the World Cup and more broadly, I guess, within, you know, the global economic system that Mexico operates within, where it's a system that tends to make the poorer poorer and the richer richer. And now, throughout, in the midst of the World Cup, negotiations for the United States-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, or the USMCA, were taking place, and Trump refused to renew this agreement. And so I was just wondering, what does this mean for Mexico and the dynamics that you've already spoken about? And is it likely to have an impact on issues raised by social movements throughout the anti-World Cup protests?
Yeah, just to explain first, the first part of the question, the agreements, it was almost like poetic in the way that they were being negotiated during the World Cup, because it was such a reflection of the same inequality that the trilateral hosting of the World Cups represented, the negotiating of this agreement. But yeah, like you said, on July 1st, Trump said that he wasn't going to renew the agreement, which does not mean that the agreement's not going to be in effect. It's still going to be in effect till 2036, but it's triggered a process of annual reviews. The annual review process is, I mean, commonly understood as just a mechanism of leverage that the United States is using to be able to force more concessions from both Mexico and Canada. And they're, once again, not bargaining really from equal positions. So it's not, I mean, Mexico doesn't really have a whole lot of bargaining power in the whole thing. The United States knows that and is instrumentalizing it to make it so that the share of value and of the most strategic sectors in North America are organized in agreement with, you know, the United States' economic and geopolitical interests, right? So this week, there's actually another negotiation going on between the United States and Mexico. The United States has decided not to negotiate trilaterally, but to negotiate individually with Canada and individually with Mexico, because that way they're able to have, once again, more power and more ability to pressure Mexico into doing what they want. But yeah, I mean, there's several clauses in the existing agreement that have put Mexico in a place of, you know, structural subordination to the United States, and also has just completely handed over any sort of sovereign control over Mexican resources to the United States interests. But with these renegotiations, all of that is going to deepen. And so the three things that the United States is mostly pushing for is, A, to make sure that the supply chains in North America are structured around the United States. Second thing is making sure that China has less influence over investments and imports, and particularly in Mexico. And then also trying to impede on sovereignty, just like energy sovereignty, particularly in Mexico. Mexico is a large oil exporter, and they have a massive, it's a state-owned company called Pemex that up until 2013 had a state monopoly over gas and oil. And 2013, the hydrocarbon sector was liberalized once again under Peña Nieto. But what the United States wants is they want the Mexican state to have increasingly less and less control over that surplus that's generated from Mexico's own resources, right? From the oil that they're taking from their own land. And they want it to be more and more regulated by the market economy, not by the state, which once again, ultimately benefits the United States, right? Just because of structural systems of global capital as they currently exist.
And I imagine sort of restricts then, you know, if there's not money coming into state coffers, there's less money to invest within the like health systems and the education sector. And so there's just less, there's more restrictions on the Mexican government with what they can do when the funds been channeled back out of the country.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. So it's a really important fight, but once again, it's one that's not being fought on an equal playing field.
Now, I really wish we didn't have to wrap up, Isa, because this is, I always just want to keep speaking and this is so, so interesting. But as we do wrap up, I thought something perhaps a little bit more lighthearted, jovial, a little bit of a joke, but also maybe not. I thought we could turn to recent comments made by Trump regarding future World Cups. Now, he's proposed to the FIFA president hosting the event in the US again, however, this time excluding Mexico and Canada. I'm just wondering, is this something that you think Mexican people might be relieved to hear after all that's occurred in the 2026 World Cup?
Oh my God, no, that's so funny. No, I don't. I doubt it. I think that comment is just like, it is the epitome of Trumpism. No, it's like, it's a comment that just perfectly reflects this idea of American first and general American exceptionalism, which we always have to remind ourselves didn't start with Trump, right? I mean, the United States has history of, you know, of decades and decades and decades of imperial violence that didn't just start in 2024 with Trump's second term. But I think it's funny because I've actually kind of heard the same thing in Mexico, where everybody's like, you know, like, the United States has been terrible. They've ruined all they've really sucked all the fun, all the love, all the passion, all the art, the collectivity, community and culture out of the game. And I think Mexico has really, and just Mexican culture and Mexican people has really, they've really made an effort to bring that back. And so I've actually heard here kind of similar comments that next time, let's just exclude all of the European countries, all of the global superpowers, and have a global South People's World Cup, which I think would be incredible.
That would be incredible. That would be great. That's something that I would get behind for sure. Well, thank you so much, Isa, for being on the show. We've been speaking with Isabel Maria Villalon, and it's just been wonderful. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. It was wonderful to talk to you.
And that was Isabel Maria Villalon, who's an independent researcher living and studying in Mexico, and we spoke to her about the legacy left behind by the 2026 World Cup throughout Mexico City and more broadly throughout Mexico. And on to our next piece. We will be listening to a podcast produced with All the Best Radio and international audio producer Craig Garrett, which talks us through the growing push for reproductive healthcare leave across Australia. It features Emma Hardy, who is a writer with lived experience of managing PMDD in the workplace, Carolyn Dunbar, the women's team leader at the Victorian Trades Hall Council and advocate for the union's campaign It's for Everybody, as well as Tom Havala, a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne who adopts a feminist approach to push for greater legal protections within the workplace. A quick note, this podcast mentions suicide and self-harm. If you or anyone you know needs support, you can call Lifeline on 131114 or Suicide Line Victoria on 1300 651 251.
Doctors are now saying that the pain we feel when we experience period cramps is equivalent to the pain we feel when we have a heart attack. And we didn't know that before because male medical researchers weren't getting periods. And they didn't know that was a thing they needed to research.
As comedian Sashir Zameta highlights, women's reproductive health has been historically underfunded and clinically deprioritised. What's not so funny are the effects that this has had on the daily lives of women and those menstruating, including in the workplace, a space where women were once denied access due to pervasive beliefs they were emotionally unstable or impaired during menstruation.
With PMDD, you do not have room for your bad days. You are just at capacity. You can be extremely emotionally volatile. You can be a lot of the stereotypes that exist around women at work.
Emma Hardy is a writer who suffers from PMDD, or premenstrual dysphoric disorder, a severe form of PMS that affects roughly 3 to 8% of people who menstruate.
What I needed at one point with when my PMDD wasn't particularly well treated was I needed time to focus on getting on the right medicine, treating it with therapy, and I found that extremely difficult to access. I was taking medicine for PMDD and the side effects just blew me out of the water. There's more money, way more money, in research into male pattern balding than there is into premenstrual illnesses. Until very, very recently, we have not tested medicine on people who menstruate for the very fact that it creates variables that make it harder to track whether that medicine's working. But that variable is a variable that I live with.
Also, up until recently, the political will within Australia to explore options for women and those struggling with reproductive health issues at work has mirrored the broader approach to women's reproductive health research, undercooked. Carolyn Dunbar is the lead of the women's team at the Victorian Trades Hall Council. She has been fighting for greater recognition of reproductive health issues within the workplace across the state and country.
There haven't been many tools that workers have had to be able to manage their reproductive health issues, whether that's menstruation or whether that's menopause or issues with fertility. So it has been a big gap, I think, in our workplace laws.
Tom Mavala is a PhD candidate at Melbourne Law School who researches women's access to reproductive health care from a labour law perspective.
The first account that I can or I'm aware of is like Victorian Women's Trust. I think 2016, they had a paid period leave type provision. And then slowly what's happened is that's really gained in momentum. Quite recent in the last few years, we've seen it be implemented in the Victorian Public Service, but then also in Queensland. But then where the momentum's really kicked in is where we start to see that across like enterprise agreements and modern awards, and we're not there yet.
Wow. Once a month.
Every month. It's the same old tune.
Tylenol and Advil only treat cramps, not bloating, not fatigue.
It's really no stretch to argue that a lack of workplace laws protecting the reproductive rights of women and those menstruating has enabled ongoing stigma, silence, and discrimination within the workplace. Majority of us are still expected to stay quiet, take a painkiller, and get on with it. In 2024, the Victorian Trades Hall Council conducted a survey on how reproductive health issues affect workers across the state. Here's Carolyn again.
Workers reported that they experienced a broad range of reproductive health issues, but 64% of respondents said that menstruation had impacted their ability to work. Over 80% of workers reported using other leave to deal with reproductive health issues. Nearly half of all workers had lost pay because of an issue. We know in particular that women, particularly women who have family or caring responsibilities, which are obviously also outsized still, are frequently using all of their sick and carers' time.
Emma's problematic diagnosis and treatment of her PMDD made it difficult for her to balance her work commitments.
I went on a pill called Yaz, which is used in America to treat PMDD, but what I wasn't aware of is that it can really go either way. So my body reacted very badly to the progesterone, and within a few hours of taking that pill, I felt pretty much catatonic. I found myself suddenly very suicidal, which is a very terrifying and vulnerable place to be. And when I was in that vulnerable place, I suddenly now had to advocate for myself to take leave at work. I was not in a position to advocate for myself at all. So I ended up taking my sick leave and my annual leave, but I needed longer than 2 weeks. My only option was to take unpaid leave. And my mental health was still not great at this time. And the decision kind of, for me, came down to, well, if I'm going to kill myself, I don't need the money, so I don't need to work. If I'm not going to kill myself, then I do need the money, so I can't take time off work, which is not great logic. So I ended up going back to work after those 2 weeks. Look, I can pretty confidently say I was not the best employee during that time, but I definitely felt resentment from my employers. They wanted to know how to help me be a better employee, but taking the time I needed off wasn't necessarily what they felt was helpful to them.
Carolyn and Tom have each heard of similar instances throughout their work.
There is still a whole lot of stigma about accessing paid leave or even talking about these issues at work. And there's a lot of really reasonable reasons why people don't talk about it. Fear of job loss, retaliation, actual retaliation and job loss because of reporting these issues. You know, people dealing with mainly male managements where these issues are simply not well understood.
Chatting to someone who we interviewed for this BMC Women's Health paper on endometriosis in the workplace, they were employed as a retail employee and they'd had time off for their endo to undergo a laparoscopy. A little while later, they were going for a promotion and I was surprised that their manager even, frankly, was kind of silly enough to say this, but they said, we're not going to give you this promotional opportunity because we, you know, you've been taking time off work for these sorts of procedures and we just can't really rely on you in that sense.
Australia's workplace laws still fail to properly recognise and support the reproductive health needs of women. As the Australian Council of Trade Unions has pointed out, reproductive health is not a niche concern, it's a universal one. This bill is a compassionate fix, but it must be the beginning and not the end.
Momentum is building to introduce paid reproductive healthcare leave into national employment standards. The Australian Greens and Health Services Union are backing 12 days of leave, while the Australian Council of Trade Unions is proposing 10, with Carolyn playing a key role in its It's For Everybody campaign.
We recognise as a union movement that everybody, no matter their age, their sex, their gender, is going to face a reproductive health issue at some point in their working life. This leave would provide leave in addition to their personal carers and sick leave to be able to treat and manage reproductive health issues. The other thing that it will do, and it is equally as important, is accessing flexible work arrangements for reproductive health issues. So if you're experiencing, you know, for example, a bad period or bad bleeds or, you know, insomnia related to menopausal symptoms, it may be that you need to work from home if you can.
While Tom views reproductive healthcare leave as a positive step forward, he does see some potential drawbacks of the initiative.
I think it's a really positive start. I think some of it depends on how it's introduced to workplaces. Ideally, and what's been argued is the National Employment Standards, which is in the Fair Work Act, and that would be the best way to do it because it's the most widely available. But even then, it's tricky because the question is, who is this most accessible to? And commonly, because of eligibility requirements and so on, it's typically full-time employees. But those people ironically tend to be men who might not actually have these reproductive health needs, at least to the same extent as women, because it's often women who are more casually employed. And yeah, again, you look at this in the sense of it's, you know, in a broader context in which there's a gender pay gap. The other flip side of sometimes in this conversation is, well, this comes at a cost. How do we actually pay for that? When you talk to particularly, say, small businesses and medium-sized businesses, it does come at a cost. As sort of reluctantly as I say, that is a really important part of the conversation as well.
Emma views the proposed healthcare leave as an important advocacy and awareness tool. She also recognises its potential for the cultural reframing of reproductive health issues, a topic she touches on in her book.
So my book, Periodic Bitch, is out in May. It is a literary exploration of premenstrual illness and the ways that our illnesses are impacted culturally.
I think it's like really deeply embedded in our culture to view things like PMS or PMDD as either non-existent or completely normal. And I think that embedding this in workplaces allows us to make that cultural shift of saying that this isn't normal. you shouldn't feel like you're going to kill yourself before you get your period. And if you need to take a day off work and go to your doctor or just practice sitting through this discomfort without added societal pressures, that's not lazy or wrong. That is you being sick in a way that we're not used to seeing people talk about illness. And so I think it's a really important step to do that cultural work, as well as give people who aren't in a position to necessarily advocate for themselves a framework with which that advocacy piece is done already, and they are allowed and entitled to take that time off. The generosity of having time and space afforded to me would have been a kindness that I wasn't ready to afford myself.
That's all we have time for on today's show. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and you just heard a podcast produced with all the best radio about the growing push for reproductive healthcare leave across Australia, featuring Emma Hardy, Carolyn Dunbar, and Tom Havala. Now, again, if you do need to speak with someone after this segment, you can call Lifeline on 131114 or Suicide Line Victoria on 1300 651 251. And this story was originally produced for FBI Radio's audio storytelling program, All the Best, published in June 2026. Now, a quick rundown of what we covered on today's show. First up, we caught up with veteran broadcaster and activist Marisa Sposaro of 3CR's Doing Time show, who spoke with us about disability support funding for blind and vision impaired people. We then heard from Dr. Sabrina Suluai Mahuka, founder of youth-centered environmental organization Finafinau, who joined us from Pangopango to discuss recent progress in the U.S. government's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's moves to advance offshore mineral extraction in the waters off American Samoa. After that, we heard a conversation between Kate and Isabel Maria Villalon, who is an independent researcher living and studying in Mexico City, and spoke about the toxic legacy of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. And as you just heard, we listened then to a podcast produced with All the Best Radio on the growing push for reproductive healthcare leave. That's all we've got time for today, and we will catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.